Welcome to Guerrilla Radio. Well, just hours ago, Canada's Federal Court of Appeals released its decision on a First Nations suit against the National Energy Board's greenlighting of the pipeline formerly known as Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Expansion. The First Nations and their co-litigants argued not only did the Government of Canada fail to fulfill its mandated duty to provide meaningful consultation before allowing a major project affecting their lands and/or the people's ability to pursue their treaty-guaranteed way of life, but the project, too, threatens Pacific salmon and the endangered southern resident orca. It's an important decision that will be watched very closely, says Will George of the Tsleil-Waututh First Nation. But the fact the federal government bought out Kinder Morgan and the Prime Minister has promised the pipeline will be completed left little drama as to which way the federal court's decision was likely to go. But surprise! Dar Jamal is a Truth Out staff reporter and author of the books The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, and with William Rivers Pitt, The Mass Destruction of Iraq, Why It Is Happening and Who Is Responsible. Dar's latest article at Truth Out is, For Native Americans, History Continues to Repeat Itself. Dar Jamal in the first half. And it's the summer of fire here in BC, just like last year and the year before. And next year, we can expect the same. Because of these fires, my second guest reminds, British Columbia has become a larger emitter of greenhouse gases than our Mordor-like neighbor, Alberta. Think on that a moment. Igmar Lee is a longtime BC-based environmental defender from the Nanaimo watershed and First Growth Valley bottoms of Vancouver Island to Cathedral Grove and the threatened sandhill crane nesting grounds of British Columbia's mid-coast. Igmar has advocated for and stood between an increasingly fragile ecosystem and big business and its government enablers. Igmar Lee and BC, land of smoke and ashes in the second half. And Victoria-based activist and CFUV radio broadcaster Janine Bancroft will be here at the bottom of the hour with the Left Coast Events Bulletin of some of the good things to be gotten up to in and around our town in the coming week. But first, Dar Jamal and Past as Present and Prologue for First Nations Across Turtle Island. Stick around. Well, welcome back to the program, Dar.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be with you again.
Well, it's really maybe even better today, Dar, because unexpectedly, despite my original script, the Canadian Appeals Court ruled in favor of a First Nations litigation. It's a stunner, and it has us all still shaking our heads here. But yeah, say again, the courts have ruled in favor of the First Nations. You know, raise a flag and buy a balloon, I guess. Dar, I'm looking at your article that I mentioned in the prologue, and there's a picture here of Native American protesters at another pipeline, the Dakota Access. How is that struggle going, and how do your courts in the United States treat First Nations claims like the one so far successful today here in Canada?
Well, it's different worlds, Chris, and I'd start with saying it is a nice relief to hear this rare piece of good news amidst everything that's happening on the planet, especially down here where I'm talking to you from in what I call Trumpistan now. So it really is a completely different world. I mean, you look at Standing Rock and other pipeline fights led largely by Native Americans down here in the United States as compared to this huge victory that you just had up there in Canada. I'm smiling. It makes me very happy to hear this news, although the cynic in me as a journalist covering these things and knowing how deep this disease of what we're going to talk about today that you asked me on the show that I address in this article, this disease of Wetiko is what Native American scholar Jack Forbes calls it, which is essentially a disease of, he calls it a sickness of exploitation and a cannibal disease. Because you look at what's happened down here in the United States, where there's literally never been a treaty that the U.S. government signed with the Native Americans that they have withheld over time. Literally not one out of hundreds, and that's what I get. That's part of what I get into in this article. So it's at least good to see that even if it is just a holding action and something that staves off this onslaught of Western so-called civilization and the destruction it causes to land and Native populations around the world, even if it's just a temporary holding action, it's still a very market victory and one that allows us to take a deep breath.
Well, yeah, people are celebrating, but celebrating, as you say, with a measure of caution, because the government here still has another avenue, can go to the Supreme Court, I mean, its own court. So, I mean, that's always been a bit of a puzzle to me, talking about conflict of interest here, now that the government owns the pipeline and it's going to go to its own court to say whether it's okay if it runs it. So, I mean, but still, it is a monumental turning point. And that's what's so strange here, too, is that we have to celebrate when the court comes down with a basic ruling. The judge who wrote the decision, Eleanor Dawson, her logic is inescapable, and it's simple. And really, you know, a high schooler could have come up with the same argument, but for some reason, the arguments become so complicated and they meander in and out and baffle people, when actually the point of law was very basic. I mean, and I imagine the same thing is true for you guys down south, is that this isn't jet propulsion or anything like this. I mean, these are basic issues of sustainability and justice, right?
Well, in a logical, rational universe, yes. What one would think, it would make absolute sense to take, you know, have fresh water and keep it that way, and have resources that aren't under threat of being polluted by oil and pipeline explosions and oil spills and things like this. I mean, and clean air, clear air for us to breathe, and then of course the healthy food that would go along with those things. I mean, one would think that it would be in our best interest for courts and governments to make sure that these things are taken care of, and to protect people like native populations that are really on the front lines of trying to protect these things that sustain us all. One would think so. So it's heartening to see that, at least even if it's a temporary thing, that a court has ruled in favor of that in Canada, because just south of the border from you here, in our world down here, it's literally the opposite, where the Trump administration has stacked the courts all the way up to the Supreme Court, where it's nothing but exploitation of resources and keeping the fossil fuel industry, which is a dying dinosaur. I mean, this is literally a situation where, you know, there's legislation going through in the state of California as of yesterday. It's working its way up to the governor's desk to sign, where they're going to ban all fossil fuels by 2045. In the state as a means of energy production. And so this is huge. So on local level, some of these good fights are being fought down here. But ultimately, if any of these cases go all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, they're doomed, because the courts are stacked. And there's now hundreds of federal judgeships around the country and federal courts where they're also stacked. So it's really a horrible situation down here where, again, it's literally the other end of the spectrum from this victory that you have experienced up there today.
Well, what value, Dar, is that to make a pronouncement that, you know, 20 or 30 years down the road, something's going to be done? Does that not run the risk of actually blunting activism and then, you know, kicking something so far down the field that nobody really has any responsibility to act today?
It is certainly risky, and I think we've talked about it before, that any of these goals, we look at what's happening. I don't need to tell you guys up there in D.C. how extreme the situation is and how far off the rails we already are, that kicking something down the road, you know, even just a few years at this point, I think is laughable and almost insulting to our intelligence, when especially tell that to the people up in D.C. who are losing their homes and their farms and everything that they hold dear from these wildfires, that we now know and understand that this is the new normal. It's going to be this way every summer going forward until there's nothing left to burn. This is the world that we've created for ourselves because of fossil fuels. So talking about, oh, well, we're going to start phasing things out by 2045, even though it's only 2018, and it is a bit of a joke, but, you know, in the United States, this for us is what we have to classify as a victory, because held up against what the Trump administration is doing to everything else, at least this is something at least pointed in the right direction. And so we're grasping at straws down here, and that's all we have. But yes, in the grander context of how fast the climate disruption is now, charging forward with extreme weather events. And just look across the entire Northern Hemisphere for this summer of the record heat waves and the hundreds and hundreds of people who have died from them, the wildfires, droughts in other areas, floods in other areas. It's just one huge example after another. And you know, if there's a silver lining to all of that here, it's that certainly, even in some of our mainstream corporate media, it's become so extreme that it's becoming undeniable. So we're starting to see some op-eds in some of the bigger corporate papers, et cetera, where people are talking about, hey, this is the new normal, and we're going to have large sections of the country where people are made nomads from wildfires coming in and burning up everything that they own.
Well, yeah, yesterday, this year was deemed in British Columbia the worst ever fire season in recorded history, and we still haven't had rain. So, I mean, it's not over yet. But I read a refutation of what you just said, of this being the new normal. It's too late for that, Dara. I mean, this person argued, and I thought sensibly, that we're along a continuum, that there is no normal, that this is just, we're along this continuum to the new worseness. You know, like things are just going to be worse and worse and worse as we go along until, as you say, there's nothing left to burn.
I completely agree. There is no more normal, because normal implies stasis, right, or something that's going to remain static at least for a certain period of time. And given that, you know, one of the articles I'm working on now is sort of a revisitation of the feedback loops that have kicked in. And these are nonlinear feedback loops, which means, you know, linear also implies something that's predictable. We're going to go from point A to point B in a certain amount of time, whether it's temperature increase or sea level rise or the number of wildfires, et cetera. But in these positive feedback loops, and so many of them kicking in and then feeding off one another and creating runaway scenarios that literally models cannot predict, this is, you know, you can't model it. And this is why the reality of climate disruption, of these record wildfires, these record high temperatures that are now happening almost every single year at this point, that, you know, we don't know where this is going to go other than things are spinning out so fast. And so, for example, up in the Arctic, by losing the sea ice, the summer sea ice, which we're doing now, every year it's getting lower and lower, both in extent, volume, depth, as well as the amount of multi-year sea ice that exists. This is already affecting global weather patterns. It's shifting the jet stream. It's causing other extreme weather events here and other places around the world. So this, you know, there's not a normal. You can't predict these things. You know they're only going to keep intensifying. So I think that's a very important point for all of us to remember. And I think all of us are going to keep writing about and talking about these nonlinear feedback loops going forward, because people are going to have to understand this concept of exponential growth, because that is now the era that we're in regarding climate change.
Yeah, it's frightening and terrifying, as always, to talk to you. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking with Dara Jamal. Dara's a Truth Out staff reporter. That's truthout.org. He's the author of the books The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, and with William Rivers Pitt, The Mass Destruction of Iraq, Why It Is Happening and Who Is Responsible. We're speaking ostensibly about Dara's latest article at Truth Out. For Native Americans, history continues to repeat itself. And of course, if you've just tuned in, the big news is that history took a little jolt to the left here today with a ruling actually going in favor of First Nations litigants who are trying to stop the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain expansion pipeline, which of course is no longer the Kinder Morgan pipeline. It's the Yours and Mine Canada pipeline. And today, Dara, as well, in the bowels of the Kinder Morgan octopus, the shareholders voted to okay the sale. I can't imagine, like 99%, 1% said no. I don't know who that person was, but to unload this turkey onto Canada. What about this, Dar? What about in the halls of finance and in other places, where is resistance down there being expressed in any sort of adequate way?
Down here in the United States?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's really not. I mean, as I mentioned before, that's why I think it's very important to point out what's happened with the court situation here, because any kind of organized, if there's not one right now, but let's say there is a very, very broad scale, effectively organized movement. And when I say what I would classify a movement as effective is it stopping the government who's essentially at this point owned and working on behalf of the fossil fuel industry and the oil infrastructure and everything that goes along with that, is there a movement that's effectively blocking it from doing what it's trying to do at this point? And there's not. There's not victories. And then I bring up the courts because ultimately anything would have to go through the courts, just like what you're talking about happened in Canada today. And given that the courts are all completely now bought and paid for by these hyper-conservative Republicans, all of them appointees by the Trump administration, leading all the way up to the Supreme Court, which at the end of the day, every lawsuit, it's going, you know, even if there's a minor victory on in a lower court, it's going to be appealed repeatedly until it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, which already now is a majority of conservatives by the previous appointee from the Trump administration, and one more now potentially with Kavanaugh about to go in there. So even if he didn't get successfully appointed, there will be another one. There's enough time. They will get another conservative judge in there. So at the end of the day, everything is going to end up in the courts, and they're all stacked. So what does that say for the future of this country, that we are really left in a situation where the government's going to do the bidding of the fossil fuel industry, and it's going to be left to us as citizens as to how are we going to take care of ourselves living in a country now where that is the case, because the courts are no longer going to be a resource for us.
Well, and again, you know, in your article, Dar, for Native Americans, history continues to repeat itself. You quote Stan Rushworth and talking about the courts, and he says the rule of law is what people say we are based on, but rule of law is based on a society's moral behavior. And with Indians, there is nothing but contradiction there. There is this huge cognitive dissonance. I mean, is there any even an understanding in the United States? Up here, there is at least a spoken determination to address reconciliation with First Nations. Is there anything like that in the U.S.?
Certainly not on a national level at all. I mean, there's going to be local instances of that, but what Rushworth talks about is absolutely true. And you know, he talks about the fact that the cognitive dissonance in what he refers to as a moral wound in this country, which means someone believing something is one way and then being slapped in the face with a hard reality that it's not. And effectively, they've been either intellectually or morally betrayed. And he starts it with going all the way back to the fact that this country was founded on the genocide of the indigenous population. In California alone, in a matter of just a few decades, there was a 90% annihilation of 90% of the indigenous population there. And that type of phenomena happened across the entire country, where it was a U.S.-led Western expansionism across the country that essentially literally was an annihilation of the indigenous population. And that is not addressed in public schooling here, or only in very, very small, local, isolated levels is that even discussed. That type of, anyone talking about it or writing about it is marginalized. And so until that genocide is addressed adequately and healed, and starting with the education of young children and letting that work its way up through the adult population over time, that this country is not going to get anywhere, because it's basically built on top of a completely rotten, fictitious foundation.
Well, and Canada, too, is built on the bones of the First Nations, and it's not really recognized, I don't think, at a visceral level amongst the colonial and the post-colonial immigrant peoples here, but we have it ensconced in our legal system, as you do. I'm looking at Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, rather. The treaties are made between these nations and are supposed to be ironclad and not disused, just like the treaties that guaranteed here in Canada that this pipeline couldn't go through without meaningful consultation. The ruling today, again, has gone against the government, but they will appeal it. I haven't heard the announcement yet, but it's coming any minute. They will take it to the Supreme Court, and what they'll be arguing is, no, we don't have to honor the treaties that have been signed, essentially.
That's right. That's right. And that's why another Apache elder named Harold Dick Jr. that I quote in the article, he talks specifically about, you know, that article in the U.S. Constitution. And then he kind of makes the joke where one of the old indigenous chiefs here said, well, they should put us on wheels so that the, when they changed the treaties, they could just roll us out of the way. And then Harold Jr. goes on to say, the first thing that the white settlers do when they came in is they take all of it, and no matter how much there is, they take more of it. And that's why I start that piece talking about Wapiko disease, which Jack Forbes basically named in his book Columbus and Other Cannibals, because as he writes, few if any societies on the face of the earth has ever been as avaricious, cruel, violent, and aggressive as have certain European populations. And by this he means the fact that when Europeans came over to the United States, or to Turtle Island in his terms, and had and indigenous populations had first contact, since that time, millions of them have been annihilated, along with their primary food source of the buffalo. It was a rapacious spreading of this Wapiko disease that continues to this day. And that's why in the article these folks are talking about what we're seeing today of this exploitation of resources and horrible treatment of indigenous populations, especially here in the United States, is simply a continuation of this Wapiko disease, where people are essentially desensitized and kind of born into this system of, it's okay to exploit resources. It's okay to treat the earth the way that we do. It's okay to build these pipelines that foul and contaminate environments, let alone the fact that they're the sources of our food and water and clean air. It's okay to do that because, it's all about having more and more, meaning materialism, profit, et cetera. And what's lost in that process now, as we're seeing with runaway climate change, what's lost in that process is the biosphere itself.
Yeah, take, take, take. I think the Buddhists call it the hungry ghost. That, you know, it can never be satiated. It just has to keep on eating. And in this case, we're eating the very ground that we stand on, the planet that we stand on, this desiccated apple that we're going to be left with. Dara, we only got a minute left. You say that you've got an article coming up. I know you're writing about the Arctic. You're from Alaska. The Arctic is an issue that is often ignored here in Canada. Believe it or not, we tend to keep our gaze focused fixedly on the south. Can you give us a teaser about your next piece?
Well, it's a very intense situation in that one of the scientists that I interview in the article is a person who's actually worked closely with NASA, particularly studying methane over the years, and he essentially says that he expects the global population, when all is said and done with these feedback loops kicking in and methane releases, that he expects it to be reduced down to something around 1 billion people.
1 billion. So, like, that means 6/7 of us are going to disappear.
That's what he foresees, given the major, major climatic shifts that are already in process. You know, talking about the Arctic feedback loops and the slowing down of the Gulf Current over in the Atlantic, and all of the things and the abrupt climate changes that are happening across the planet as a result of that, among several other things. And this is just talking about feedback loops stemming from what's happening in the Arctic, let alone the rest of the planet.
Well, Dar, it's been good to know you, and it's been good to speak to you again, and I hope we get a chance before the end to speak one more time at least.
Oh, thanks, Chris. I imagine that we will. This is definitely still all heating up at this point, but it's always good to be on your show and be able to talk about what's actually really happening in the world, as opposed to how much of the corporate press, certainly down here, is reporting on it.
Well, and check out Dar's writing at truthout.org, and they're having a fundraiser right now. Thanks again, Dar.
Thanks, Chris.
Bye-bye. Now I'm going to take a brief break, and Janine will be back with this week's Left Coast Events Bulletin right after this.
Tonight, Thursday, August 30th, Protect What You Love, Southern Resident Killer Whale Town Hall at the David Strong Building at UVic, 7 till 9. Everyone's welcome to attend. This is focused on the state of the endangered southern resident killer whales and the risks they face here in the Salish Sea. Misty McDuffie will be speaking. She's a renowned biologist and program director for the Wild Salmon Program at the Rain Coast Conservation Foundation. There will be time for questions. She'll be talking about the relationship between the orcas and the wild Chinook salmon, pipeline concerns, scenarios for spill impact and response, and more. Natalie Chambers for a Saanich Council campaign is sponsoring this event tonight, 7 till 9 at David Strong Building, C103 at UVic. Also this afternoon, the People's Apothecary Free Herbal Workshops at the Vancouver Island School of Art, 2549 Quadra Street. There is a garden tour at 4, and then a couple of workshops with gratitude to the holistic medicine students at Pacific Rim College who are sharing their time and knowledge. If you do attend and you can help with a bit of weeding and garden maintenance, these gardens do rely on volunteer labor. So tonight, August 30th, 4 till 7 o'clock at 2549 Quadra. This weekend on Saturday in Port Moody, the New West Free Market, Poems for Mother Earth, Volume 2. This is a celebration of life without money. You're invited to take a break from capitalism and enjoy some priceless fun at your local bi-weekly community carnival. It's a belief that conversation around protecting Mother Earth is something that needs our ongoing efforts, and all poets, free thinkers are invited to speak at the open mic. We'll have an opportunity to play some music off of your phone, celebrate dance, come and teach yoga, share your skills, teach weaving, scribble a poem, whatever you enjoy doing, come and share your talents with your community and talk about building a community free of capitalism and full of collaboration. So Saturday, 12 till 4 at Moody Park, 6th Avenue and 9th Street, I guess in Port Moody or New Westminster, perhaps. That up on Facebook, New West Free Market. Volunteer Day at the Sanctuary, also on Saturday, at a Home for Hooves Farm Sanctuary. Needs some help. Meeting the animals is an option here, of course, as the sanctuary is prepared for the upcoming change in weather. There will be some grass seed spreading and pulling the invasive hogweed, that sort of activity. So they're just looking for 15 people to attend. And if you are interested, check again the Facebook Volunteer Day at the Sanctuary, September 1st, 10 till 1. Saturday night, Summer Star Parties, Dominion Astrophysical Observatory. These are free, and there are dome tours, planetary shows, programs for kids, and more than that, every Saturday night. Parking is limited, though, so please carpool Saturday, 7:30 till 10:45 at the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory, 5071 West Saanich Road in Victoria. Paddle this weekend for James Island. The Saawut Chief and Council are inviting all relations and neighboring communities to participate in support of Saawut's claim to the island, also known as James Island. I'm not going to try to pronounce the First Nations name there. The history of use and occupation is significant, combined with a significant archaeological history. The island was part of the homelands of the Saawut people and provided a rich, productive way of life, as it was well supplied with plant life and surrounded by a rich variety of saltwater food supply in the form of fish and shellfish. When it was taken over as part of the war efforts, it was still occupied, and people felt that the island would be fully returned once it was no longer required. However, history shows that the Saawut Saanich people were forced off the island, and it became privatized and eventually sold. The past Saawut have made overtures to have the island rightfully returned. However, that hasn't happened, so there's a paddle on Sunday, starting at 9, Cordova Spit, and everyone's invited to participate in canoes, kayaks, and other human-powered watercraft, and it'll be about 3 hours. There's some information booths on the beach, and there'll be a vendor's market at Saawut Gymnasium with an Indigenous tea room in the multi-purpose room opening at 10. At 2, invited speakers will talk about the significance of the island, and this will be a fundraiser to assist with the research and legal work required for the claim, and they will be accepting donations made out to the Saawut First Nation. For more information, check turningthetide.ca. This weekend also, Chris, is Labor Day. The Victoria Labor Council is inviting everybody to the front lawn of the legislature, 11 till 2, to reflect on the powerful influence of unions to allow us to have reasonable working lives. And 11 till 2 at the legislature on Monday. And that's all I got for this week. Thanks, Chris.
Well, and thank you, Janine. I'm going to take another brief break and see if I can't screw up Igmar Lee way up there in Bella Bella. So please stick around for that.
Get messed up when the times get rough. favorite record on, baby. I fill the bathtub up. You wanna say goodbye to your oldest friends with a good goddamn, with a good goddamn. Lay out your clothes. It's time to go. It's always darkest before the dawn. The sun never shows. But say goodbye to your oldest friend. There's a good God damn. Maybe there's a good God damn. Maybe there's a good God damn. Maybe there's a good God damn. Could be a good God damn. Could be a good God damn. Maybe there's a good God.
To Guerrilla Radio. Summer, it's the summer of fire and smoke here in BC, and just like last year and the year before and the next year, we can expect it's going to be the same. Because of these fires, my second guest reminds, British Columbia has become a larger emitter of greenhouse gases than our Mordor-like neighbor, Alberta. Now, just think on that a minute. Igmar Lee is a longtime BC-based environment defender from the Nanaimo watershed and First Growth Valley Bottoms of Vancouver Island to Cathedral Grove and the threatened sandhill crane nesting grounds of BC's mid-coast. Igmar has advocated for and stood between an increasingly fragile ecosystem and big business and its government enablers. He says, like in Alberta, where, quote, thou shalt not criticize nor recognize the tar sands the tar sands contribution to the global climate change emergency. Here in BC, the mantra is, thou shalt not criticize nor recognize the significant and direct responsibility of voracious industrial logging to rampant cataclysmic forest fires. Welcome back to the show, Igmar.
Oh, great to be back, Chris.
Well, Igmar, I haven't heard very many people make the connection between the logging practices here or in any parts of Western North America that's burning right now with these great big fires. Why is that?
Well, I think it's a lot to do with the fact that all of BC's forest professionals, as they call themselves, professional foresters that manage BC's forests, all of them work for big logging, to a man, and they are mostly men, I'm afraid.
And so, and then, and this is the catechism then, is that thou shalt not bite the hand that feeds?
Well, I guess so. You know, I mean, I was a tree planter in British Columbia for 21 years. And every year for 21 years, we would start in here on the coast and start planting into the denuded mountainsides of the West Coast. And then as the snow receded across the province, we'd basically follow the snow line right across BC, up and end up our seasons either in Alberta or way up in Fort Nelson, British Columbia. And, you know, nobody really gets to see the state of BC's forests quite like tree planters do. You know, these foresters might get a career in one or two valleys for their entire lives, and whereas tree planters, you know, we're crawling right through the every inch, so to speak, of the industrial wreckage of big logging.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're on the ground and you're crawling through this stuff, you can see, you know, they take the middle, the lower parts of the log, and, you know, the branches and all the needles and everything else is all left behind in a big pile of slash. And, you know, the simple fact of the matter is, and I don't believe it takes a scientist to see it, is the sun burns down through the, right onto the ground, because there's no more shady canopy covering all the slash. It desiccates the slash, the wind gets in there, it dries everything right out, and when these forests start, the wind just whiffs it right across the clear cut and into the edge forest, where it ladders right up into the canopy, and then you have a raging canopy fire just walking right across the landscape. Simple as that, and yet every year we see the same old hand-wringing, desperate queries about, you know, people, evacuations and smoke, whining about all the smoke and everything like that, and not a word about the actual major impactor on the British Columbia forests. You know, I mean, take a look out the window next time you're flying across BC. It's a patchwork of clear cuts, mm-hmm. as far as the eye can see, in every direction.
Well, if the timber companies took that that understory of dried out cut materials and pine needles, would they still be able to do business? Would it be so economically onerous that they just would go out of business?
Well, I don't know. I don't really understand the economics of the business very well. It looks like a huge ripoff. Like up here in, near Bella Bella, where I live, and I'm looking out the window here, right by the, I'm on the wharf in downtown Bella Bella now, and, you know, on a weekly basis, we see huge towering barge loads of 100% cedar just going south, straight south. There's very little of that ends up running through the local, tiny little local sawmills here. It's all, you know, 100% cedar. That's where the money is right now. There's you don't see any barge loads of hemlock and spruce and all the other kinds of wood that grows up here. And so, you know, presumably that's all getting left behind. Now, I'd just like to mention that I have a good friend in Japan, and he tells me he can go down to the lumberyard in Japan and buy absolutely perfectly milled in Japan, by the way, Vancouver Island Douglas fir planks for cheaper than what you can get in Vancouver Island. You know, these planks are perfection milled. You don't have to rip through the pile and throw away all the chaff to find the good planks like you do here. They get the best logs, and, you know, that's the kind of economics that's running our forest industry here. And, you know, that's the way it is.
Well, and when you talk about tree planting, Igmar, when you replant, are you replanting a variety of species? Are you replanting trees that might help to slow down forest fires, or is it just a monoculture?
No, yeah, that idea that we're out there planting monocultures is a media frame that just won't die. I mean, it's amazing that big logging hasn't been able to get that one out of the general public consciousness. No, I mean, ever since I started tree planting in the late 70s, we've always planted a mixed bag. I mean, you know, you get four or five different species in your bags and you plunk them in. Now, we can't know. I mean, you know, when you're planting on Vancouver Island, you're quite often on private land and quite often on private land that's supposedly owned, in brackets, by giant transnational, usually American logging companies. You don't know whether they're using GMO Franken trees clones. I mean, I think they're mostly clones, but no, we do plant the mixed bag. It's still, you know, basically, I mean, you know, especially here on the coast, the natural regeneration that blows in from the surrounding forests takes care of it. I mean, the tree planting, I think, is mostly public relations, and perhaps the general argument is that if you can get the new crop to punch through the brush layer faster, then they get it off the books sooner and don't have to worry about it anymore. I believe they're responsible for the clear cut until the new growth is punched through the brush layer.
What about the pine needle, or the pine beetle, rather? Is that still a big factor in these fires or in BC forests?
Oh, I'm sure it is. And But more importantly, the pine beetle is also a symptom of catastrophic global emergency of climate change. As the heat and the long, I mean, we were here in Bella Bella, we had virtually no rain here for 2 months. This is the so-called Great Bear Rainforest. I mean, we were one idiot with a cigarette butt away from being on fire here ourselves. And, you know, the forests here are just crackling explosive dry. But, you know, the pine beetle, the fires. We were out on our sailboat here on the most pristine coastline on the planet. And, you know, the water for the whole 2 weeks where we went to, you know, Aristizable Island, Banks Island, Campania Island, it was absolutely plugged with jellyfish. There's this just massive jellyfish everywhere. You know, we didn't go swimming because, you know, you're just swimming through blobs and tentacles of jellyfish everywhere. And, you know, that's a symptom of global warming as well, as is the deer flies. I mean, they were just absolutely voracious this year. And my own experience tells me that the deer fly season seems to prolong by, a week or two every year. Yeah. And now, you know, whereas we used to have them for 3 weeks, deer flies, this year they were, you know, there for a month and a half. And, I think these global pestilences, pine beetles, other biting insects, fires, and jellyfish, that's what happens when a planet is being killed.
Oh, God, it doesn't paint a very pretty picture. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Igmar Lee. Igmar is a longtime environment defender. He's up, as he says, in Bella Bella, the mid-coast of British Columbia. He's been at this for a very long time. You know, talking about timber interests, Igmar, reminds me, I think the first time we spoke 16 or 17 years ago, you were still working for the timber companies, and the American corporations were bringing in the dross from industrial plants from the chimney stacks to use as a fertilizer in the Nanaimo watershed. Is that something that's still going on?
Well, you know, I've been out of tree planting for a long time. In fact, I was basically run out of the business for exposing the dioxin and heavy metal laced fertilizers that we were being forced to plant. I'm not really sure. I mean, I've noticed that the glyphosate applications seem to be out of control. You know, the the nozzle heads at the Association of BC Professional Foresters are just, you know, spewing glyphosate all over the place to kill off any of the deciduous. And that goes back to the whole idea that they've got to get their plantations past the brush layer before they can get them off their out of their responsibility. So, you know, that's what they learn. All these foresters, they're all educated at UBC. You can go around the UBC Forestry campus, and it's the Sauder School of Forestry. You know, it's all just funded by big industry, and these foresters, that's what they want. They want a job with big logging. And, you know, that's what they learn. They learn how to figure out where the most valuable last remaining tract of forest is on a licensee's area of operations and how to get in there and rip it out as cheap as possible. And then after that's been done, then how to get that area of landscape off of their books as fast as possible so they can move on to the next. That's what modern forestry is about. And, you know, in when I first started tree planting, a rotation was supposed to be 80 years, and that being the idea that you start into a watershed, you start logging, you take 1/80th of it a year, and by the time you get to the back of the watershed, you can start again at the front. But, you know, they logged so fast, absolutely destroyed Vancouver Island. Like, it's just heartbreaking. Took them 150 years to log the first half of Vancouver Island, the primeval forest. The second half was destroyed in just 30 years, and the subsequent growth forests are just being exterminated right down through the age classes. 80-year trees are all gone. The 60-year-old trees are all gone. Nowadays, you see the 30-year-old pecker poles, you know, trees that I planted myself, being run down the highway. And, you know, ultimately, the plan is, as far as I can see, it's all about fiber per year per hectare, and take the fiber off with a lawnmower every year in the future.
Well, you can make more money with your money with interest in the bank than you can with trees growing, as Dr. Suzuki reminds. Well, Igmore, fast forward to today now. You've been running the 10,000-ton oil tanker Facebook page. I mentioned with Dar earlier this landmark ruling. Do you want to talk a little bit about this pipeline ruling that came out of Vancouver just a few hours ago?
Well, yeah, I mean, it sparks, I'm first of all very interested in the deafening wall of silence, the eerie wall of silence that we're hearing from big oil lackey Justin Trudeau and his sidekick Rachel Notley. They just shut their mouth, and these people usually can't wait to get out there and blather in front of a camera. I'm also, you know, I'm very grateful to the BC Court of Appeal for their, or the Federal Court of Appeal for their unanimous ruling. It sort of gives you a bit of faith that the justice system isn't entirely bought by big industry like the political system is. You know, unfortunately, our provincial justices, like that creep Judge Justice Affleck that's throwing conscientious citizens in jail and fining them the big bucks for trying to protest this farcical assault on our province, the Kinder Morgan assault on our province. I mean, there's all kinds of questions. The Kinder Morgan shareholders themselves, 99% of virtually unanimous, let's get the hell out of this this nasty business vote on the same day that we find out that the whole process was an absolute sham. The National Energy Board, I mean, we've been through this before. We've been to the funeral of Enbridge, which was defeated for virtually the same reasons. So what kind of an idiot do we have as a prime minister that was so fucking ignorant that could not look at the Enbridge decision, that just bullshitted his way in, you know, with this soppy lie of First Nations reconciliation and everything? and gets himself into this idiotic, nightmarish problem that hopefully will defeat him, you know, to waste our money on this stupid pipeline. I mean, even in China, they don't want this dirty oil. I mean, they're not, it's not even going there. I mean, the whole thing is just incredible, and I just can't wait to hear the slimy connivings that they're going to try to twist this as they attempt to, you know, regain the media control of the story. But that's just, I'll tell you, I was just crying tears of delight this morning, to be honest.
Well, and I was rewriting my script from this morning, because I had written quite smarmily that, you know, the courts are never going to reverse, you know, I mean, the prime minister and all this sort of stuff. And yet...
I know. I bet the prime minister had written his own speech, was already in... you know, freshly shaven out of bed to make the big victory speech this morning himself, but he ran out of things to say after the decision. Yeah, I mean, I'm so delighted. I mean, I've been to the point where, Chris, to be frank, I've been missing old Stevie lately.
Stephen,
you know, I
Harper.
Mean, at least he didn't purport to. He didn't try to be anything other than the rotten industry lackey crook that he was, unlike, you know, Trudeau. But,
that's always the argument, too. I mean, you know, when people see the NDP, you know, going forward with fracking and so forth, you know, they say, well, at least the old BC Liberals never pretended to be anything other. Well, Charlie Smith has a piece in the Strait, the Georgia Strait, that's strait.com, about this announcement. And it's a good piece, and it goes over the thinking behind the ruling. And it seems like a pretty easy decision to make when you see it in plain English. It's not so complicated. There wasn't consultation, and the increased oil tanker traffic threatens the whales and the salmon and everything else, if should there be a spill, and never mind all that. Igmar, they're still running tankers. There's another generation of oil barges, rather, to be run up and down the Inside Passage. In the last minute we have, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, luckily, and I'm very grateful that the Sierra Club of BC has now allowed one person day per week of their staff. Mark Worthing is now onto the ATB issue, these Alaska-bound tankers, 10,000 deadweight ton tankers that ply the BC coast once every 2 weeks. The entire coast, right up the Inside Passage. You know, it's been a long time. The environmental angles have been very loth to get involved in this issue, but it's happening now. We've got some great people that we're working with as a transboundary issue. Fred Feltman, who's the port commissioner for the Port of Seattle, just a green as grass, and he did his PhD on orca whale feeding habitats and stuff like that, is breathing fire on the on this ATB issue. I mean,
well, listen, Igmar, you know, Igmar, we could go on and on, but I've got to get off the air now, or they're going to be upset with me, and especially with what follows. But we'll talk again, eh?
Okay, Chris.
All right.
Nice talking to you. Miss you. Come on up and visit.
I'll be there. Till the next time, then, Igmar. And thanks, too, to Dar Jamal and to Janine Bancroft and all the people that make things work week in and week out. That's all I got for this week. Found you waiting there for me.